A Russian Beauty. Olga, of whom we are about to speak, was born in the year 1900 in a wealthy, carefree family of nobles. A pale little girl in a white sailor suit with a side parting in her chestnut hair and such merry eyes that everyone kissed her there. She was deemed a beauty since childhood. The purity of her profile, the expression of her closed lips, the silkiness of her tresses that reached to the small of her back, all this was enchanting indeed. Her childhood passed festively, securely, and gaily, as was the custom in our country since the days of old. A sunbeam falling on the cover of a Bibliothèque Rose volume at the family estate, the classical hoarfrost of the St. Petersburg public gardens. A supply of memories such as these comprised her sole dowry when she left Russia in the spring of 1919. Everything happened in full accord with the style of the period. Her mother died of typhus, her brother was executed by the firing squad. All these are ready-made formulae, of course, the usual dreary small talk. But it all did happen. There is no other way of saying it, and it's no use turning up your nose. Well, then, in 1919, we have a grown-up young lady with a pale, broad face that overdid things in terms of the regularity of its features, but just the same, very lovely. Tall, with soft breasts, she always wears a black jumper and a scarf around her white neck and holds an English cigarette in her slender-fingered hand, with a prominent little bone just above the wrist. Yet there was a time in her life at the end of 1916 or so when, at a summer resort near the family estate, there was no schoolboy who did not plan to shoot himself because of her. There was no university student who would not. In a word, there had been a special magic about her, which, had it lasted, would have wreaked, but somehow nothing came of it. Things failed to develop, or else happened to no purpose. There were flowers that she was too lazy to put in a vase. There were strolls in the twilight, now with this one, now with another, followed by the blind alley of a kiss. She spoke French fluently, pronouncing les gens, the servants, as if rhyming with agence, and splitting ou, August, in two syllables, au. She naively translated the Russian grabeji, robberies, as les grabuges, quarrels, and used some archaic French locutions that had somehow survived in old Russian families. But she rolled her R's most convincingly, even though she had never been to France. Over the dresser in her Berlin room, a postcard of Sirov's portrait of the Tsar was fastened with a pin with a fake turquoise head. She was religious, but at times a fit of giggles would overcome her in church. She wrote verse with that terrifying facility typical of young Russian girls of her generation, patriotic verse, humorous verse, any kind of verse at all. For about 6 years, that is, until 1926, she resided in a boarding house on the Augsburger Straße, not far from the clock, together with her father, a broad-shouldered, beetle-browed old man with a yellowish mustache and with tight, narrow trousers on his spindly legs. He had a job with some optimistic firm, was noted for his decency and kindness, and was never one to turn down a drink. In Berlin, Olga gradually acquired a large group of friends, all of them young Russians. A certain jaunty tone was established. Let's go to the Cinemonkey, or that was a heely-deely German-deely dance hall. All sorts of popular sayings, cant phrases, imitations of imitations were much in demand. These cutlets are grim. I wonder who's kissing her now. Or in a hoarse, choking voice, Messieurs les officiers. At the Zotovs, in their overheated rooms, she languidly danced the foxtrot to the sound of the gramophone, shifting the elongated calf of her leg not without grace and holding away from her the cigarette she had just finished smoking. And when her eyes located the ashtray that revolved with the music, she would shove the butt into it without missing a step. How charmingly, how meaningfully she could raise the wine glass to her lips, secretly drinking to the health of a third party as she looked through her lashes at the one who had confided in her. How she loved to sit in the corner of the sofa, discussing with this person or that somebody else's affairs of the heart, the oscillation of chances, the probability of a declaration, all this indirectly by hints, and how understandingly her eyes would smile, pure, wide-open eyes with barely noticeable freckles on the thin, faintly bluish skin underneath and around them. But as for herself, no one fell in love with her. And this was why she long remembered the boor who pawed her at a charity ball and afterwards wept on her bare shoulder. He was challenged to a duel by the little Baron R, but refused to fight. The word boor, by the way, was used by Olga on any and every occasion. Such boors, she would sing out in chest tones, languidly and affectionately. What a boor! Aren't they boors? But presently her life darkened. Something was finished. People were already getting up to leave. How quickly! Her father died. She moved to another street. She stopped seeing her friends, knitted the little bonnets in fashion, and gave cheap French lessons at some ladies' club or other. In this way, her life dragged on to the age of 30. She was still the same beauty, with that enchanting slant of the widely spaced eyes, and with that rarest line of lips into which the geometry of the smile seems to be already inscribed. But her hair lost its shine and was poorly cut. Her black tailored suit was in its fourth year. Her hands, with their glistening but untidy fingernails, were roped with veins and were shaking from nervousness and from her wretched, continuous smoking. And we'd best pass over in silence the state of her stockings. Now, when the silken insides of her handbag were in tatters, at least there was always the hope of finding a stray coin. Now, when she was so tired, now, when putting on her only pair of shoes, she had to force herself not to think of their soles, just as when, swallowing her pride, she entered the tobacconist's. She forbade herself to think of how much she already owed there, now that there was no longer the least hope of returning to Russia, and hatred had become so habitual that it almost ceased to be a sin. Now that the sun was getting behind the chimney, Olga would occasionally be tormented by the luxury of certain advertisements written in the saliva of Tantalus, imagining herself wealthy, wearing that dress, sketched with the aid of three or four insolent lines, on that ship deck, under that palm tree, at the balustrade of that white terrace. And then there was also another thing or two that she missed. One day, almost knocking her off her feet, her one-time friend Vera rushed like a whirlwind out of a telephone booth, in a hurry, as always, loaded with parcels, with a shaggy-eyed terrier whose leash immediately became wound twice around her skirt. She pounced upon Olga, imploring her to come and stay at their summer villa, saying that it was fate itself, that it was wonderful, and how have you been, and are there many suitors? No, my dear, I'm no longer that age, answered Olga. And besides, she added a little detail, and Vera burst out laughing, letting her parcels sink almost to the ground. No, seriously, said Olga with a smile. Vera continued coaxing her, pulling at the terrier, turning this way and that. Olga, starting all at once to speak through her nose, borrowed some money from her. Vera adored arranging things, be it a party with punch, a visa, or a wedding. Now she avidly took up arranging Olga's fate. The matchmaker within you has been aroused, joked her husband, an elderly, bald, shaven head, monocle. Olga arrived on a bright August day. She was immediately dressed in one of Vera's frocks. Her hairdo and makeup were changed. She swore languidly, but yielded. And how festively the floorboards creaked in the merry little villa. How the little mirrors suspended in the green orchard to frighten off birds flashed and sparkled. A Russified German named Forstmann, a well-off athletic widower, author of books on hunting, came to spend a week. He had long been asking Vera to find him a bride, a real Russian beauty. He had a massive, strong nose with a fine pink vein on its high bridge. He was polite, silent, at times even morose, but knew how to form instantly, and while no one noticed, an eternal friendship with a dog or with a child. With his arrival, Olga became difficult. Listless and irritable, she did all the wrong things, and she knew that they were wrong. When the conversation turned to old Russia, Vera tried to make her show off her past. It seemed to her that everything she said was a lie, and that everyone understood that it was a lie, and therefore she stubbornly refused to say the things that Vera was trying to extract from her, and in general would not cooperate in any way. On the veranda, they would slam their cards down hard. Everyone would go off together for a stroll through the woods, but Forstmann conversed mostly with Vera's husband, and, recalling some pranks of their youth, the two of them would turn red with laughter, lag behind, and collapse on the moss. On the eve of Forstmann's departure, they were playing cards in the veranda, as they usually did in the evening. Suddenly, Olga felt an impossible spasm in her throat. She still managed to smile and to leave without undue haste. Vera knocked on her door, but she did not open. In the middle of the night, having swatted a multitude of sleepy flies and smoked continuously to the point where she was no longer able to inhale, irritated, depressed, hating herself and everyone, Olga went into the garden. There, the crickets stridulated, the branches swayed, an occasional apple fell with a taut thud, and the moon performed calisthenics on the whitewashed wall of the chicken coop. Early in the morning she came out again and sat down on the porch step that was already hot. Forstmann, wearing a dark blue bathrobe, sat next to her, and, clearing his throat, asked if she would consent to become his spouse. That was the very word he used. Spouse. When they came to breakfast, Vera, her husband, and his maiden cousin, in utter silence, were performing non-existent dances, each in a different corner, and Olga drawled out, in an affectionate voice, "What bores!" And next summer, she died in childbirth. That's all. Of course, there may be some sort of sequel, but it is not known to me. In such cases, instead of getting bogged down in guesswork, I repeat the words of the Merry King in my favorite fairy tale, "Which arrow flies forever? The arrow that has hit its mark."